It's a good place to be. There's no place like being at church where the Word of God is proclaimed, and I'm very excited to be here. What an afternoon, but we were still talking out of the house at 6 o'clock. We were still talking about the house. Well, you know, I'm going to watch. You know? It's kind of how I said, well, I got to go study. I got to teach tonight at church. But we're still talking at 6 o'clock. We're still talking about concrete. But here we are. I'm very excited to be here. Zechariah chapter 6. We're going to go through the whole chapter here. And there's two parts. We're going to see the eighth and final vision. And let's begin with the eighth and final vision. And then it's going to drop down. What we spend is the first six chapters kind of in the spiritual realm, seeing visions and what's been taking place, prophecies about things that are going to take place in the immediate future and in far in the future. But then we're going to drop down halfway through this chapter into some things that they're actually going to put their hands on and do. There's still going to be just as, if you want to say, supernatural things, just as significant, as just as spiritual, but it's going to be more things that are actually taking place right there in their midst, and we're going to become more historical. And, well, let's just begin and see what happens. To tell you what we're going to talk about, let's talk about it. Chapter 6, verse 1. I looked up again, and there before me were four chariots coming out from between two mountains, mountains of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, the fourth dappled, all of them powerful. I asked the angel who was speaking to me, "What are these, my lord?" The angel answered me, "These are the four spirits of heaven, going out from standing in the presence of the Lord of the whole world. The one with the black horse is going towards the north country, the one with the white horse towards the west, the one with the dappled horses towards the south." They say nothing about the red horses. "When the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth. And he said, 'Go throughout the earth.' So they went throughout the earth. Then he called me, 'Look, those going toward the north country have given my spirit rest in the land of the north.'" When it begins there, it says, "I looked up again, and there before me were four chariots coming out from between two mountains, mountains of bronze." What we're talking about here, whenever you see the word bronze in Scripture, it refers to judgment. I got some references just want to flip through real quickly. Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21, one of the first times we come into the word bronze. Numbers chapter 21, verse 9. We won't read through the whole story there, but you remember where Moses is leading the people in the wilderness, and they began murmuring and griping about all these things. And the Lord sent snakes among them, and they began to bite the snakes. Or the snakes began to bite the people. Don't bite the snakes. I always tell the kids, if you see a snake, don't bite it. But the snakes would latch on the people, and it poisoned them, and they were dying. Several thousands of them died here. It may say, if I can see it real quickly, many, many Israelites died. It doesn't say the number. And the Lord had them take and shape a bronze snake and lift it up on a pole, and anyone who looked at that snake would be healed. Jesus used this as an example or a type of himself in John when he was speaking with Nicodemus. It says, "So the snake was lifted up in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that all who look at him will be saved." Again, it's a type of faith, just looking, no work, just seeing the snake. But the snake spoke of judgment. The snake, the bronze snake, the snake was going to be judged instead of the people, and there's a transference of sins similar to Jesus Christ. So right away, the bronze speaks of judgment. Another example is in Exodus 27, verse 2. We won't look that up. But the outside, we've spoken of the temple or the tabernacle and how we had the curtain or the fence going all the way around, about 150 feet long and 75 feet wide. And then you had the tent on the inside, the actual, what you call the tabernacle, that was divided into two parts, the outer holy place, and then the inner most holy place. Everything in that temple, or tabernacle, either one, if it was a tent or if it was a temple later on, was made out of gold. All the furniture. The two items outside were the bronze altar and the bronze basin. Because out in the outer court was where judgment took place. That was where the animals were sacrificed. And then over in the bronze basin, that was where they washed their hands of the blood and would look and see how they, if all the blood was washed off. And the finalized, the result of the judgment was taken care of. And they would go into the tabernacle itself. So inside was gold, outside was bronze. Again, bronze speaking of judgment. the bronze altar was a type of the cross of Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ was not sacrificed on an altar, he was sacrificed on the cross, but the altar was a type of the judgment that he received. And then when he would scream out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That was when he received the judgment. There's one other example of judgment that we want to look at, and I'd like to have you turn to the book of Revelation. And what we're doing is identifying the word bronze with judgment. Bronze refers to judgment. And the word bronze mountains has come up in our verse, meaning these chariots are coming up out of a valley between two bronze mountains. So, of course, if they're coming out from between bronze mountains, they're coming out of a place of judgment. In Revelation chapter 1, a picture of Jesus Christ, this is the same person that John the Apostle knew when he walked on the earth with Jesus for those 3 years of ministry. But his appearance is quite different. Same person, same man, same God, but his appearance is different. And it describes him here, we'll just start in verse 14, his head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in the furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. And he goes on and talks more about it. But when Jesus Christ, right now today, in this revelation of Jesus Christ, he is seen as having bronze feet. When he returns, he is seen as having bronze feet. Now, has he become some kind of a metallic being? No, the bronze feet speak of what he will do. It says he will trample the nations as in a great a wine press. And again, it speaks of the judgment. When he returns, he will bring judgment to the earth. So bronze, again, is speaking of judgment. Let's go back to Zechariah chapter 6. I looked up again, and there before me were four chariots coming out from between two mountains, mountains of bronze. This, all these occurrences are like when we saw the myrtle trees. We saw horses go out at the time with the myrtle trees, the very first vision. And they went out to see the earth, and they had come back, and they says, we find peace throughout the world. And the Lord was not pleased with that because he wanted some vengeance. He wanted some judgment brought about on some of these nations that we'll see taking place here. But the place, the myrtle trees, were identified, the location of the vision, as being outside of Jerusalem. The two mountains referred to here are probably the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion, which is in Jerusalem. Mount Zion is where the... I wish we had a map. I was going to get it overhead. But you've got the city of Jerusalem, and to the... It'd be to the east, but just pretend this is the east. You've got the city of Jerusalem, and Mount Zion was one of the hills in Jerusalem. When we say mount, we're not talking about, you know, scaling a mountain. We're talking about mounds or hills, actually. And one of the hills was Mount Zion. And then there was a valley, which is called the Kidron Valley, that would come up, and there would be the Mount of Olives. And as you know, when Jesus was in the upper room, for example, they had the Last Supper and all, and then they sang a hymn, and they left, and they went down the valley, Kidron Valley, and up on the Mount of Olives was where he was praying, and then that was where he was arrested. And they walked back down through that valley into the city of Jerusalem. Now that valley, Kidron Valley, is very important. I mean, many times it's going to come up. And what we see right here is if there are those two mounds, the bronze judgment, coming up out of that valley is where these horses are coming from. Now I want to look at those, the Kidron Valley. Go to Joel, if you would, Joel chapter 3. And these two verses are, Joel chapter 3, are all echoing a voice into the future of what will be taking place, speaking of the day that Jesus Christ comes back. All these things have got types on them. But in Joel chapter 3, we'll look at verse 2. And that valley we just named was the Kidron Valley. Now, in chapter 3, verse 1, in those days, I'll just tell you right up front, those days are referring to the days when Jesus Christ has returned, when he has landed back on the earth and is setting up his kingdom, not the rapture, but the 7 years after the tribulation. In those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, the Valley of Jehoshaphat means the Lord judges. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is a reference to that Kidron Valley. So, when the Lord returns, he is going to set up his throne for judgment in that valley, in the Kidron Valley. There I will enter into judgment against them concerning my inheritance, my people, Israel. We can look in verse 12 It says, let the nations be roused. Let them advance into the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the nations on every side. And verse 14, it says something very similar. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. That is a second name for the Kidron Valley. The valley of Jehoshaphat or the Judgment Valley. Or is called the valley of decision. Now, just for fun, go to the book of Matthew chapter 25. And Jesus told a parable about this. Matthew chapter 25, and you're familiar with this. Verse 31. And here again, we're talking about when Jesus Christ returns to the planet. Not the rapture, but the second coming. Verse 31 of Matthew chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes in His glory. Remember, in His glory refers to when He comes. He did not come in His glory in Bethlehem. He came as a man concealing His glory, but He will return in His glory. When He comes in His glory, and all the angels with Him, He will sit on His throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him. This is the same exact occurrence. And He will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. Then the king will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed, blessed by my Father, take your inheritance. And He separates them, and you know the story. What we're looking at there is when He returns, He'll set up judgment, and He'll begin separating the people. And that place where He's going to set up judgment is the Kidron Valley, between those the Mount Zion and the Mount of Olives. I'd like to have you go to the book of Zechariah again, and we're going to skip ahead to chapter 14, verse 4. And here it is again, speaking of, a lot of the rest of this book of Zechariah is speaking of the return of the Lord. The book of Zechariah becomes a book about the return of the Lord, the second coming. And so even in chapter 14 of Zechariah, we see this. Let's begin reading in verse 1. A day of the Lord is coming, when you will plunder, when your plunder will be divided among you. Here it is again, verse 2. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. So all the nations have come against the city of Jerusalem. The city will be captured. This is right before the Lord returns. Right before Jesus Christ comes back out of heaven, this is at the very end of the tribulation. This is when things have gotten at their worst. The city of Jerusalem is being attacked and captured. The houses ransacked and the women raped. Half of the city will go into exile. That means at that point, half of the city will have already been captured, and they'll be lining up the people of Jerusalem to take them off into captivity again, just like the Babylonians did, like the Romans did later on after in 70 AD. And then now they're going to do it again. They've got half, and they're going off into exile. But the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. How come? Because this time, verse 3, then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations. He's been waiting all those years. He's had moments of deliverance. He's had times where he's led. Of course, he's always led and manipulated history. But at this time, he will go out and fight against those. That is when the sky splits apart. Jesus Christ comes back. Half the city of Jerusalem has been captured. But at that time, then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, down the Kidron Valley, east on the Mount of Olives. Now, this is something that I think is real neat, and I'm sure you've seen this before. But when he was standing on the Mount of Olives with those, I believe it was probably 120 disciples or believers, and he ascended up into the clouds, and they're all looking, and the two angels appear and says, you men of Galilee, why do you stand here looking up into the sky? That same Jesus will return the same way he left. And that answers any kind of questions. You know, where is Jesus at today? Is he here? Where is he at? You know, where is he going? He's going to come back the same way he left. Not only come back the same way he left, but come back to the same place he left. He left history off the planet on the Mount of Olives almost 2,000 years ago. And when he returns, he's going to pick up right where he left. He's going to come right back down on the Mount of Olives. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west. When he lands, there's some kind of an earthquake forming a great valley with half the mountain moving north and half the mountain moving south. So when he lands, there's an earthquake that cracks the Mount of Olives and apparently would split through the city, it says, splitting in two from east to west. So it starts where he landed, east, and splits all the way across the land of Israel, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. You understand that? There's a crack. And half the mountain will move to the north, and half of it will move to the south. And that's going to connect the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean Sea. And there's other verses here that we can look at. And what's going to end up happening is there's going to fresh water will flow through the land of Israel into the Dead Sea. And it says in Ezekiel that they will fish in the Dead Sea. It'll then go out of the bottom of the Dead Sea down to the Gulf of Aqaba, down by the Red Sea, and it'll be a transport. And right there, what they tried to do with the canal, what's that canal? Not the Panama Canal, obviously. Suez Canal. They did the Suez Canal. God will do from the Mediterranean Sea, and you'll not have to sail around after you come right in through for the millennia, for the 1,000 years. You'll sail right through Israel, right through Jerusalem, right out the Dead Sea, and down south, down around the rest of Asia. And that is going to put Jerusalem right in the center of the world. It was going to be a major seaport. Everything would be centered right on the capital of the world at that time. Now, forming a great valley with half a mountain moving north, half a mountain moving south, you will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel. And Azel then is I think it's like 25 miles south. The whole thing is going to change. And while this is taking place, we're going to bump into this later, I'll tell you now. While this is taking place, there's a change that's taking on Jerusalem. The city of Jerusalem is being raised up onto a higher mountain than it is right now. And this is going to be called the Holy Mountain. And we'll see this as we go through some other times here. Now, let's go back to the beginning of Zechariah chapter 6. What we've just established here is the fact that this valley is a very important valley, a very important place. And when it speaks of the two chariots, these chariots are coming out of a very historical place. It's almost like a center of spiritual activity, especially of judgment. God knows where the judgments are going to take place, and things are prepared and ready to go right there. And from that place, these chariots are going out. Let's see where they go out. Verse 2, the first chariot had red horses, the second black, the third white, and the fourth dappled. All of them powerful. I asked the angel who was speaking to me, what are these, my Lord? Now, there are some. Each color could represent some things. You could go to the book of Revelation and try and put some matches on them. And I'll just, I'm not necessarily sold out on this idea. But in the book of Revelation, you can see that the red horse refers to war and bloodshed. The black horse refers to famine and death. The white horse would be victory and triumph. And the dappled horse is death by plagues and judgments. So that's something that you keep in the back of your mind. Whenever you see these things repeated in Scripture, I don't know how to necessarily apply that unless when these horses go out, that's what they're taking to each of those areas. And I do not have any historical reference if any of those things actually took place, except in Babylon, of course, and Persia. They were conquered by war and bloodshed, but then the red horses don't even go anywhere. But the angel answered me, these are the four spirits of heaven, or four angels of heaven, going out from standing in the presence of the Lord of the whole world. So, again, we believe these are angels because they come from the presence of the Lord. The one with the black horse is going towards the north country. And the north country would be Babylon. And it's called the north country. Even the very beginnings of the prophecies of Jeremiah, they were warned of the country from the north. But the problem with saying that is when you look at Jerusalem, if you go north, you hit Russia. Babylon is to the east, or where Iraq is. But they did not go to Babylon going east. You could get there, but you'd have to go across the Jordan, across the desert, directly in there. So you'd have to go up through the valleys in between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean Sea, up through there to the north, and then you'd veer off and go up to Haran, kind of like Abraham's route when he came down the Euphrates River to Babylon, and that is how you travel. So you actually had to travel north, and then northwest, and then you have to go south, or northwest, and then south, north. East and then go north, southeast down to Babylon. So it's called the country of the north, even in the very beginnings of Jeremiah's prophecy. So when it says these horses were going to the north, they were going to Babylon. The one with the white horses towards the west. It does not say the west. It says they followed. If you look down in your footnotes there, it says horses after them. And what this would say is they also went north, but apparently they did of one of two things. They followed into north, or they followed them up out of the land of Israel, and then they went west then into the Mediterranean coastline and stuff. So each one's going a different direction. And, you know, it could have gone there, but it would make more logic that this one went then to the west, and that's why the NIV puts west in there. And the one with the dappled horses towards the south, and that'd be towards Egypt. So from right here, from the Kidron Valley, between the two mountains, bronze mountains, you've got horses going to Babylon, you've got horses going up and to the west, you've got horses going down into Egypt, all looking to reign and do the will of the Lord. And the red horses is not sent anywhere. I do not know why the red horses are not sent anywhere, except that in the very beginning of the book of Zechariah, you see the Lord riding a red horse. And I believe the red horses are probably the horses that are going to be stationed right there in Jerusalem. And so they're going nowhere. They're stationed at where they're supposed to be. So he sent out three horses or three chariots, and this one is sent right where it is. You stay right here and do your work right here in Jerusalem. And again, that's, you know, that's the best I could come up with why they just forget the red unless they forgot to write it in there. But there's no mistakes here. So anyway, that is where the horses are going. Now, verse 7, when the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth. Again, very, very bent on the ideal of achieving God's will. They have one thing in mind. When an angel or any of these things like in the story is given a mission, they are so focused. We can't even imagine how focused they are on what they are to do. I'm always amazed when we read in the book of Revelation about the angel that is stationed by the Euphrates River. It says there's an angel stationed there, and it will dry the river up at the appointed time. Now, that angel has been there from the beginning of time, waiting. What are you here for? I'm going to dry up the Euphrates River, or whatever is going to allow it to be dried up, or cause it to be dried up. But his job is to cause the Euphrates to be dried up. He's there today. He was there in the beginning of time. And one day, during the tribulation, he's going to do his thing. And that's it. I mean, he's waiting. He's focused. Everything is taking place. Oh, I suppose all these spiritual things are taking place that he can see, but he's waiting. I'm here to dry up the Euphrates. And it says that they've been bound there for these times. And you can see this in the way this is phrased. When the powerful horses went out, they were straining to go throughout the earth. They are so bent. There's nothing going to get in their way. No distractions. They're set on what they're going to do, and they're going to go and do what they've been told to do. And he said, go throughout the earth. And that's what they're going to do. So they went throughout the earth. In verse 8, then he called to me, look, those going towards the north country have given my spirit rest in the land of the north. And so we end the vision, the eighth vision, right where we began, where they came back and said, there's peace. And the Lord looked up and says, how long must we wait? Well, here now these horsemen sent out, and all of a sudden it says, then he called me, look, those going towards the north country have given my spirit rest. Here the Spirit of God says, or the Spirit of the Lord has rest. It says, okay, good. This is finished. So apparently those horses that had gone, the black horse that had gone to the north, had achieved their purpose. And what the Lord was, if you want to look, I'll look back here, verse 12 of verse 1. Then the angel of the Lord said, Lord Almighty, how long will you withhold mercy from Jerusalem and from the towns of Judah, which you have been angry with these 70 years? So the Lord spoke kind and comforting words to the angel who talked with me. So apparently this has something to do with that, because these horses, these chariots were released. And when they achieved their mission, here the Spirit of the Lord is now, he's got rest. Okay. He's not looking for vengeance any longer. His judgment has been satisfied. It's kind of a tough thing sometimes to think about, is that the Lord is set on judgment. But when it's time for judgment for certain groups, he's going to achieve that, and he's not satisfied until his will is accomplished. Now, the other way is also true, is when the Lord has decided to bless someone, or the Lord has looked to give someone mercy, he is bent the same way. I'm going to achieve my purpose. And so this is kind of in the negative sense, but you can see it in the same way, hopefully, in your life, when the Lord is looking to give you mercy, looking to bless you, and as he looks down, he is set on that, and he is going to achieve that purpose in your life. And he will not have rest until he has brought about his will in your life, be it judgment or be it blessing, and we're looking for blessing for all of us. Now, in verse 9, it says, the word of the Lord came to me, take silver and gold from the exiles, Heldiah, Tobiah, and Jediah, who have arrived from Babylon. Go the same day to the house of Josiah, son of Zephaniah. Take the silver and gold and make a crown and set it on the head of the high priest, Joshua, son of Jehozadak. Now, we know who Joshua is, correct? We spent some time talking about the high priest. He's the one that came back from exile. His uncle was killed. His grandfather was killed by Nebuchadnezzar. And he has come back now as the high priest. And they just had that over there in chapter 3, the clean garments. And Zechariah spoke up for him, put a turban on his head, and he's been restored to the priesthood. That is the Joshua. There's four men that are introduced here, Heldiah, Tobiah, and Jediah. And these are all called exiles, coming back from Babylon. So they had, now this is not a vision any longer, although the word of the Lord is being proclaimed in this. These three men have come back, and they have brought with them gold and silver from the land of Babylon. They've done some kind of marketing over there, or they've gotten some kind of a gift from the king, or maybe it's an actual temple gold that the king has sent back with them to bring back and restore. And they arrive. They are apparently guests at Josiah's house, and Josiah is another unknown Jew, as these other three were. And his name, as we're going to see later on, down in verse 14, he is also called Hen, H-E-N, and Hen means gracious one, which I guess that's why they're staying at his house, because he's the gracious one. But these three guys were guests at Josiah's house, and they've got gold and silver. And Zechariah says, take the silver and gold and make a crown and set it on the head of the high priest Joshua, son of Jehozadak. Tell him, this is what the Lord Almighty says. This is a very interesting thing. And again, this is what's going to happen here. They're going to make him a very elaborate crown out of gold and silver. They're going to fashion it. And these guys are going to set it on his head, and after it's been set on his head, they're to take it off of his head and take it and put it in their new temple that they're supposed to be building. But when they get their temple built, this is what they're supposed to do, and they're supposed to just set it there. Why? What good is this going to do? This is, again, teaching, laying down a principle here. It's probably what has taken place here is somebody is talking in the background here. Talking about what is, giving a prophecy about what's to take place. And we can pick up on this. Well, I'll just read this. And as you read this, some of these things just kind of slip through. But I think there's something very important that's taking place, and we can see it through Scripture. Verse 12, tell him, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Here is the man whose name is the branch. Now, do you remember who the branch is? The branch is Jesus Christ. He is the root of Jesse. There's several names for Jesus Christ, but one of the names of the servant or the Messiah is the branch, directly out of the book of Isaiah. So, when they're setting this crown on his head, they're to say, this is the branch. And they set the crown on Josiah's head. Well, this isn't Jesus. This isn't the Messiah. We know that from a lot of reasons. But why are they to say this is the branch? They're saying, this represents the branch. Well, that's what all the priestly garments represented, Jesus Christ as the high priest. So they're saying, this represents the branch. And they set the crown on his head. What they're going to do is they're going to take two things that have never been united before. Well, one time. And they're going to do it again. They're going to unite two things. They got the king and the priest. And the king could never be the priest. And the priest could never be the king. There are two different groups. The king came from the line of Judah. The priest came from the line of Levi, and a Levite could never be a king. In fact, you remember Uzziah, the king, one time got kind of arrogant, and he decided that I will go into the temple. There's no reason I can't go in the temple. I'm the king. Well, no. King, only the priest can go in the temple. That's not your rule. You can do anything you want to out here in your kingdom, but sir, don't come in here. It wouldn't be good if you came in here. Get out of my way. I am king. So he walks in there. He says, I want to burn incense before the Lord because I am king. The priest says, sir, it wouldn't be wise for you to do this. Get out of my way. I'm king. He walks up and begins to sprinkle the incense in, or however they were doing it at that time. They had the incense burner, burned it before the Lord in an incense burner. And leprosy began to grow on his forehead. And he got scared, ran out of the temple. The priest says, told you so. And then he lived in his own place all by himself. The king could not violate his position. He could not cross over and be a priest. But there is a day that is going to come where the king and the priest are going to be united. And let's just look at this. Here is the man whose name is the branch. And he will branch out from his place and build the temple of the Lord. Now, who is building the temple of the Lord in the book of Zechariah? Do you remember? It's Zerubbabel's temple. Zerubbabel has come back, and he is going to build it. He's going to have help from some Nehemiah. Well, Nehemiah will come later and build the walls. He's going to have some help from Ezra encouraging the people. Some of the prophets, Malachi and Zechariah, are going to encourage the people. But Zerubbabel is going to be the one that heads up the building process. Josiah is the priest. He won't build the temple. But the branch, which speaks of Jesus Christ the Messiah, will build a temple someday. So right here, we're talking to these people, they're acting out a skit kind of like, and they're doing things that they're not going to do. They're calling each other names that are not their names. They're putting crowns on each other's heads that mean absolutely nothing. They're going to be set back in the temple. Why did you put that on my head? God told me to. That's not, am I king now? Why do I have the crown? You don't. We just put it on your head for a moment. Give it back, and we're going to put it in the temple now. So he calls Josiah the branch. They put a crown on his head and say, It is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty, and will sit and rule on his throne. Huh? What, the priest is going to sit and rule? Now we've gone from calling the priest the king and putting a crown on his head, and then we're telling the priest to sit on the king's throne and rule the people. Now this is not normal. This is not in the law of Moses. Can't take place. But that's one of the reasons God's pointing this out. Is something different is going to take place. I want you to have this scripture reference so that when this happens, you'll understand what's going on. He'll be clothed in majesty and will sit and rule on his throne. And he will be a priest on his throne. Now do you remember in the Old Testament any time the priest sat on a throne? The priests don't have a throne. They have an altar. They work in the temple. But this priest will sit on a throne. And there will be harmony between the two. Between the two what? Between the king and the priest. Now that they're arguing, but they're going to be unity between the two. The crown will be given to Heldiah, Tobijah, Jediah, and Hen. That's Josiah's nickname, I guess, son of Zephaniah, as a memorial in the temple of the Lord. So when this is all taking place, they'll put that thing in their brand new temple, and people walk by and say, well, what's that crown for? Well, that was the day that we crowned the priest, the king, and the king became the priest, and there's some kind of message about they're going to be the same guy or something. If we just leave it sit there, it's kind of dusty, but we just leave it sit there for right now. It's going to serve as a memorial. And it was supposed to, it might have been there for hundreds of years. Those who are far away, we'll do that later. Let's go back and look at some of these verses. I want to look in verse 13. It says, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord. Now, when it says, and he will be clothed with majesty, there's a great set of verses in Isaiah 53 to point this out. I'd like to have you go to Isaiah chapter 53. We've looked at this before. Isaiah 53, speaking of the Messiah, in verse 2. Isaiah 53, verse 2. It says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot. There's that branch. And like a root out of dry ground, speaking of the virgin birth. Now, the part we're looking for is right here. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. This is Jesus Christ when he came as a servant. It said he had no majesty. Now, he did have majesty because of the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember, he took his three disciples, Peter, James, and John, and he was transfigured in front of them. It's like what was hidden the whole time by his flesh. He says, you guys come up here, I want to show you something. And they could have stood up there, and he just pulled back the veil. And they saw who he was. It's like they knew he was the Messiah, but look at what he can do. I've never seen anybody glow like that. Look at his eyes. And at that time, Moses and Elijah stood on both sides of him. But then he covered himself, concealed himself, and went back down the mountain. It's just like, don't forget what you guys saw. He did tell them, don't say anything to anybody about what you saw. But it's like, for some reason, a special treat for them. But it wasn't just to be nice to him. It was some significance that they could see it, maybe so they could write about it. That I do have glory, but I don't want to show it. If I showed everybody what I'm going to show you, everybody would follow me. But I want them to have faith, not just... He moved it back and showed them and covered himself back up. Now, he had no majesty. Now, the next time he comes, go to Isaiah chapter 63. And now we're going to be talking again about when he comes back. Now, we just talked about, in Zechariah chapter 14, about the Lord coming down and landing on the Mount of Olives, and it's splitting into all these things taking place. There are four references to Jesus Christ coming back in the Bible. Are different. Listen to this one. Who is this coming from Edom? That's a country just south of the Dead Sea. From Bozrah, that'd be the capital. With his garments stained crimson, that's red. Meaning, he's trampled through the grapes. It's blood. His garments are stained with blood. Who is this robed in splendor? First of all, here you've got Jesus Christ coming back to Jerusalem from Edom. Now, maybe he has landed on the Mount of Olives. Then he has trampled down into the country of Edom and trampled back, leading the attack against the armies of the Antichrist and nations, and now has come back up to Jerusalem. But here it says he's coming out of Edom when he returns. Again, these are things that... There's other times where it says how he comes and where he comes and what he does. But when he comes back, that time when he comes back is going to be such a great commotion. I mean, for me to stand and say, well, he's going to land on the Mount of Olives, and then everything's going to be real quiet, and he's going to walk into Jerusalem, sit on his throne, and wave to the crowd, and CNN will come and interview him. It's like, these things are, he's going to land, there's going to be an earthquake, Jerusalem's going up, water's rushing in from the Mediterranean Sea, people are running, people are screaming, the city's being attacked, they don't know if they're being delivered or being attacked by some alien force. The people are shooting at Jesus Christ with what's left of their military weapons. He apparently tramples down south of the country of Judah, way down to Edom, tramples back up leading some kind of military force and just destroying everything in his way. He comes back, he's got blood dripping off his garments, and who is this, it says, robed in splendor? Where it said in Isaiah 53, he had no majesty, this is the same Hebrew word for majesty. Who is this robed in majesty or splendor? What he did not have when he came the first time, he comes back and everybody can see it. Striding forward in greatness and of his strength, it is I, speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. Why are your garments red like those of one treading the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone. From the nations no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them down in my wrath. Their blood spattered on my garments, and I stained all my clothing. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. I looked, but there was no one to help, and it goes on. So that speaks of Jesus Christ. The point right there that we're looking at is in Zechariah, where it has said, it is he who will rebuild the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty. So we've looked at Josiah, and we says, this is the branch. It's not the branch, this is Josiah. Man, we just got him cleansed of sin. No, this is the branch. And they set a crown on his head. Wait, that's the priest. Why are you putting a king's crown on him? Should we give that to Zerubbabel? Zerubbabel's back there, remember, saying, no, don't give it to me. Don't give me. You remember why he doesn't want it, right? Zerubbabel doesn't want it because he'd be cursed and they'd come and kill him. So they put the crown on him. And now it says he's going to rebuild the temple. No, he's not going to rebuild the temple. Zerubbabel's going to rebuild the temple. Now it says he's clothed in majesty. Well, Jesus Christ, when he returns, will be clothed in majesty, Isaiah says, and will sit and rule on his throne. Let's go to Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4. And here is another reference to this the same time. Micah chapter 4, verse 3. Micah chapter 4, verse 3 says, he will judge between many peoples, and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They'll beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Every man will sit, and it speaks again of Jesus Christ, or the coming there, where he sits and judges between my people, again, sitting in judgment, or sitting on a throne, like Solomon was sitting on a throne, making judgments in his day. Here the Lord is seen sitting and ruling. Now, we have one other reference we would like to go to, and that is in Hebrews. Well, let me see. Let me go back. I don't think it's in Hebrews. Go to Hebrews. I can't remember the chapter and verse. Hebrews chapter... Yeah, that's right. Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 11. And this is what we're talking about here that is so different that they had to take a good portion of the book of Hebrews to explain it to the people so you understand who Jesus Christ is. Because apparently in the Old Testament, just like they had these two lines of scriptures, they've got the line that when the Messiah comes, he'll come on a horse. He'll come to rule. He'll come to overthrow the Gentile nations. He'll come to set up his kingdom. But then over on this side, he's going to come as a servant, a suffering servant. He's going to die for the sins of the nation. He's going to die for sins. Our sins will be upon him. Well, now, which one is our... Are we got two guys coming? Somebody thought there's two guys coming. You got the king and the servant. One guy's going to be the loser who's going to come and die for sin, but one guy's going to really be God. And so you got these two guys coming. And it was very difficult for them to put the thing together. Well, of course, we know that there's two comings. The coming to die for sins, and then the return of Jesus Christ, where he returns after having cleansed the world of sin. But then also, throughout the Old Testament, you've got the typology of the priest, which speaks of Jesus Christ. You know, the mediator, one mediator between God and man, who stands before God and represents people. The priest, our high priest. But then you've got on this side, you've got, yes, from the tribe of Judah, the line of the tribe of Judah, the king. Well, we got two guys coming? Because David could not be the priest, and Zadok could not be the king. They couldn't intermix. Same thing here. Josiah can't be the king. So it appears that there's two lines going here, and how are we going to unify these things? Well, here's the verse right here that will unify it for us, is when the Messiah comes, he's going to bring unity between them both. the priest is going to become king. Well, this has never happened before. Well, yes, it has. Hebrews chapter 7. And people argue this. Jesus Christ can be king because he came from the tribe of Judah. But he can't be priest because he didn't come from the tribe of Levi. You can't come from both tribes. You've got to come from one family or the other. There's never been a priest of God not come from the tribe of Levi. Well, yes, there has. Chapter 7. Well, let's go to verse 6. Where do we want to start? Let's start in verse 20 of chapter 6. Where Jesus, who went before us, has entered on our behalf. That's behind the curtain. He has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Not in the order of Levi or the order of some of the other priests that came from the tribe of Levi. But he's a priest, but he's not from the tribe of Levi. No, he doesn't need to be because God has found another priest that he's related to. Who? From Melchizedek. Well, who is Melchizedek? Now, you remember the story in Genesis. Abraham, his nephew Lot, who was living in Sodom, and Sodom was attacked by Chedorlaomer, which was a king from Babylon or out east, came and destroyed him, took everybody captive, and was going back home with him. And someone came and told Abraham, Abraham, someone captured your son or your nephew. Well, go help. So Abraham, from his own home, own house, takes 315 men. It says 315 trained men. I mean, they're trained for warfare. It's kind of amazing. You know, this old guy out here, some sheep and some cattle. And someone says, you know, hey, Abraham, someone captured Lot in the whole town. Well, I'll take care of it. And he calls 315 guys from out back behind his tent, and they all show up, all trained for service, for war. Yes, sir, you got a problem? Yeah, we got to go capture Chedorlaomer. Chedorlaomer came over with four kings to fight, or three other kings to fight with him against these cities. And he's been going through capturing cities and just taking everything he wants. And Abraham says, well, they got to go save Lot. Let's go, guys. And so they mount up, and in the first recorded historical night attack, Abraham, it splits up in two camps, or one side of each side of Chedorlaomer, attacks both sides, and just whips Chedorlaomer like he's never been whipped before. This is the old man Abraham with some cattle and goat and 315 trained men. I mean, and they whipped him. So much so that when they say coming back down into Israel, they've got all the gold, they've got all the people, they've got wagon loads and camel loads of just stuff because they just took everything Chedorlaomer spent, you know, 16 months getting. They just took it one night. Oh, let's take it back home. We'll find something to do with it. And Chedorlaomer, he's scrambling back to Babylon. This was one of the greatest kings. Some people, I don't know if this is true or not, but some people believe that was Hammurabi. I don't think that's true, but it was a very great king of that time. A historical man, if we could put another name with him, we'd probably got his name somewhere in history, and it's not Chedorlaomer. It's recorded as Chedorlaomer in here. But anyway, it's a very prominent man. This is not just some low-life guy. This is one of the dominant forces in the world at that time, and Abraham just whipped him. When it comes back, Abraham, of course, has kind of got two things bothering him. He's thinking that maybe this guy might come and come back and get revenge. But as he's approaching Salem with all this stuff and all the people from Sodom, he comes back. Two kings approach him. One of them comes out with bread and wine. This is in the old. This is the book of Genesis. Comes out with bread and wine. Do you think people were scripturally illiterate from the beginning of time? Here's a man. His name is Melchizedek, king of Salem, which is going to be Jerusalem. Jerusalem. This is before we came to Jerusalem. Salem. He comes out with bread and wine and says, gives Abraham a blessing and tells him, the Lord is your shield and your very great reward. Interesting. The Lord is your shield. Why does he say the Lord is your shield? Because Abraham just got done kicking Chedorlaomer out of the country, and he knows good and well Chedorlaomer didn't have a bad, just had a bad night maybe, and he's going to be back. And he's thinking, I don't know if I can do that twice. It's like, you know, upsetting the team. It's like, I don't know if I can do that twice. And his first words were, Abraham, you're worried, but the Lord is your shield. And that should have given him some peace. And he says, and your very great reward. Now, I don't care how great a person you are. If you've got as much stuff packed up on camels like Abraham did that night, you're having a real hard time thinking about God. You're having a real hard time thinking about giving it to the church. You're thinking about how stinking wealthy you are. It's like, that's a lot of stuff. And that was the other thing. Abraham was ready to go off the deep end in one.